You are listening to The Secrets of Once Upon a Time on SQPN.com, the StarQuest production network, leading the way. This episode is brought to you by Bluehost. Create your own website or blog with a .com domain name for just $6.95 per month. Go to onceuponatime.sqpn.com and click on the Bluehost banner for more information. And by the Amazon Store. Shop at Amazon by clicking on our Amazon link at onceuponatime.sqpn.com, and your purchase will help support our show. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Once Upon a Time. Well, The Secrets of Once Upon a Time, the podcast that is dedicated to trying to find what inspired the stories that we see every week on TV in the ABC series Once Upon a Time. Joining me today is a full panel of show hosts, and let's start with Lisa, who is back in the land of the living. Hey, Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Father.
So what was the problem?
I had pneumonia. My son had pneumonia last month, and unfortunately, I contracted it on Thanksgiving, and
terrible.
Really sick.
Oh, but you're feeling better, I assume.
Much, much better.
Fantastic. Well, glad to have you back. And also joining us today was your temporary replacement, but she did such a great job that we wanted her back as a regular. And it's, of course, Shelley. Hey, Shelley.
Hi, Father.
Good to have you back, and I'm eager to hear your theories about the episode that we're going to talk about today. But we'll get to that in a minute. But first of all, I want to introduce our third co-host, and that is David Handlos. Hey, David, how are you doing?
Doing good, Father.
Good to have you. You are on a mobile phone, I assume, using mobile Skype. So the sound quality might be sometimes it might sound like a telephone, but there's nothing wrong. As long as we can understand each other, I don't think there's a problem. Well, today we will be talking about a pretty dramatic episode, one with, not really a happy ending, at least certainly not for Miss Blanchard, I should say. And it was also an episode with many hidden layers, or, you know, the things that we love to talk about here is what were the original fairy tales and the myths and everything that inspired the episode that we've seen. Now, the episode title is The Shepherd, and of course that refers to the story arc of one of the main characters in the episode, Prince Charming, and we get to discover a lot more about him, about the backstory, about his family, and in the process we also discover a little bit more backstory about, the princess that he was supposed to marry, and the princess that he actually marries, Snow White, that is. And so a great episode that fills in some of the blanks, some of the questions, it answers some of the questions that we had in previous episodes of this podcast. And so let's do what we always do in this show and take a look at the episode and see if together we can find the details, the Easter eggs, the important plot points, and all that, all the stuff that some of our listeners might have missed. And so, well, let's start with the fairy tale.
These stories, the classics, it's a reason we all know them. They're a way for us to deal with our world. Well, if it doesn't always make sense, believing in even the possibility of a happy ending is a very powerful thing.
So I think the main fairy tale in this episode was not really a fairy tale as such, but it is a very famous story that is retold in many different cultures. And it's, of course, the story of the slaying of the dragon. And that goes back to even ancient mythology. I've read somewhere that even in Egypt, in ancient Egypt, they had stories about warriors beating fire-breathing animals. And then, of course, the most famous story that we know is from the, I think it was written down in the 11th century, but the roots of the story might be older. And it's St. George and the dragon. And then, of course, the dragons kept reappearing in medieval tales and later on, especially in fairy tales. So, But of course, the dragon, that's somewhere halfway through the episode. Let me ask the panelist about the details. Let's just follow the story. And whenever you have a detail that you want to mention, just go ahead. And so, Lisa, can you remind me how the episode started?
I'm trying to remember. It opened with the scene with him fighting James, Prince Charming, fighting another warrior in like a duel and
yes.
slaying him. And then immediately we had a kind of a shocking opening to the episode where he himself is killed.
Yes, it was dramatic.
It was. I mean, you sat there and wondered, what's going to happen this whole, you know, what is this leading up to? And we learned that his father, did we have a name for him?
His father? Yeah, I think so, but I forgot.
Well, he was meeting with King Midas. It was nice to see that thrown in there and, making a deal between kingdoms. Mm-hmm. And then he was slain and he was set up to go kill this dragon for King Midas. And it was a very powerful opening.
Yes, and intriguing. Go ahead, Shelley.
I was going to say, didn't see that one coming.
No, especially no. because my initial thought was, but it was because I'd already read some stuff online. It's like, oh, this must be Prince Charming's brother. But
yeah.
I was still surprised. I still didn't see it coming. Because I thought that we would see the other brother, you know, but we had this wild idea in previous episodes that actually Prince Charming was a brother of Prince Thomas. Who, mm-hmm. who was the husband of Cinderella, but I think that theory might have been disproven in this episode. But that was a brother; he just happened to be an identical twin. So, any details in that opening scene that you've noticed or that we need to talk about, David? What did you notice in that scene?
Well, in that scene. I'm probably merging the scenes a little bit here, but mm-hmm. we have this big brash warrior prince who claims he can defeat anything, and he's almost unfortunately pretty much after he says that he's almost immediately killed, and then they have a bit of a prince and the pauper deal where his brother is the complete opposite, where he's this humble shepherd who wants to marry for love.
Yes.
And so it's very, very, very different. And I don't want to skip ahead too far there, but just the differences between the two, I'm not sure if based on the way that the real prince behaved, I'm not sure he would have been. I honestly think the dragon later in the episode would have killed him, because I don't think he would have thought of the approach that James thought of.
Yes, it's very interesting to see the two. They have something in common, and that's their bravery. They don't seem to be afraid of anything or anyone. It's just mm-hmm. that David. And I don't know exactly, what's his name? Well, he's just Prince Charming in the fairy tale world, I assume. Or was his name James? I forgot.
Well, that was a very interesting point.
Yeah, is his name really, what is his name in the fairy tale world really James? Or is James the name of his brother who he's pretending to be?
Oh, that's interesting. Who else was, Shelley, were you saying something?
I think,
go ahead.
What was interesting to me was James is the name of the prince.
Uh-huh.
And so they never gave us the shepherd's name. And they call him David in the real world, but of course the minute they showed the shepherd, what's the first thing you think of? David and Goliath and David.
Exactly.
And the shepherd. And so I kept waiting for them to say his name, but the mother only says my sweet boy or my boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a real interesting twist.
Interesting.
And then the fact that his name is David in the real world, you're like,
Yeah, well, the story of David and Goliath and King David and his origins as a shepherd are, of course, very much emphasized in this episode. We'll get to that, but I think we skipped actually the opening scene of the episode where we see that David is now with his wife, standing in front of their home, and he doesn't really recognize it. The windmill is gone. That's what his wife reminds him of. That is, and there is this welcoming party because he's finally, you know, released from the hospital, and it's very interesting. I don't know if you noticed the way that they dressed the set on the inside of his house. Everything is kind of green. Green balloons, green and blue balloons. Even Dr. Will has a green tie. And almost everything, the cushions, the couch, the curtains, have decorations in the shape of branches or trees. And I thought it was a very interesting reference, of course, to the past of Storybrooke, that it's basically used to be the forest or the enchanted forest or whatever you want to call it. And there's even a very, I think, significant detail when David talks to Emma and Henry, who are also at this welcoming party, and that those are the only ones that he really knows. You see a mirror, and in the mirror you see the reflection of a painting, and it shows some kind of fairy tale forest. Now, whenever you see a mirror in stories, that always symbolizes the other reality, or the underlying reality, or the parallel universe, if you want to. And so I thought it was an interesting visual reference to the fact that there is this other reality, which is the Enchanted Forest, that is just on the other side of this reality.
And they use that again in a later scene. We didn't recap, so I'm going to jump a little bit.
Sure.
Mary Margaret, when he's having a conversation with Mary Margaret in the school the following day, her whole room is decorated with those cut out tree trunks and bare branches.
True.
And my daughter noticed it was the exact same as the opening of the show when they do the little recap and then they have the credit line with the picture.
Uh huh.
And the picture is different in every episode.
Yes.
My daughters were all excited. Oh, look, it's a dragon.
Mm hmm.
But the other thing I noticed, you mentioned the green. Did you notice the wallpaper?
No.
The wallpaper in the kitchen. Had blue and pink roses on the background. And that blue and pink roses, okay, you caught it too, came up in a lot of other places
on
clothing and in walls and in backgrounds.
Huh.
And I couldn't decide
if it was a style choice for the set director or if there was a purpose to it. But I can't believe they do anything accidentally like that on the show. So it had to reflect something. I just couldn't put together maybe what it was.
Me neither. And I had the same question as to the green and blue balloons. Is why the green and the blue? Is there some meaning to that? Or is it indeed, as you say, it's just a stylistic choice? But they know that we're freeze-framing these episodes and that we're going and scrutinizing every detail. And even on the ABC website, they invite us to do so. And they want us to speculate about all the details. But there might be red herrings in there as well, or just things to... They think that we... or they want us to believe that there is a meaning to every single object. I mean, I was looking at the paintings behind the couch. Mm-hmm. I was like, what's the meaning of the painting? I mean, the middle painting was a boy carrying a branch, and then from the branch there are three flowers sprouting out of the branch. I was like, is that some kind of a symbol, or does it just refer again to the forest, or is it some kind of biblical reference to the branch of Jesse? You know, the ancient story of the old tree that there's a new branch which symbolizes the new life, which is a reference to Mary. So could that be? I mean, you get all these like very complicated associations, and I never know if it's just me who is trying to find connections everywhere, or whether this is done on purpose. Time will tell, I guess.
Well, going back to the party, Henry introduced his interesting theory for why David had amnesia. Did you catch that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The curse wasn't working on him yet because he basically, remember, he had been attacked and he was unconscious when the curse occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was in that coma. Waking up, that's why he was still trapped. I think Henry said he was still trapped between the two.
Yes.
And they just had to reintroduce to him. I love the little thing about ever used a sword much?
Oh, because he's using that, what is it, to pick up
a toothpick on the...
A toothpick, yes.
Yeah,
and, but he swirls it around like as if it were a sword. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's a very interesting plot point, and also important, I think, that Henry reveals that all the memories that the characters in Storybrooke have are fake, are implanted memories, which, of course, is extremely important when it comes to the relationship between Prince Charming or David and Miss Blanchard and Abigail, which is the fairy tale name of David's wife. I sometimes get very confused with all these different names. And so, well, do we have a Storybrooke name for Abigail?
Is her Storybrooke.
I think it's Catherine.
Sorry,
Catherine.
Catherine.
There you go. It's Catherine.
The real world.
Yes. So, Catherine seems to be genuine in her whole approach. At first I thought she might be playing, you know, that she might be actually pretending to be his wife, and that Regina was actually in charge. Well, in a way, Regina did cause this situation, and in a way, she is pretending to be the wife of David, because in reality, she's not. That is just a fake memory. But to them, it's true. And so that explains why she can be genuine, and at the same time, well, it's not really true that the two are married. That was just part of the curse. It's an effect of the curse.
Speaking of Regina, mm-hmm. How interesting was that when Catherine said, it's been a long time since I've had a friend. And the look that kind of crossed Regina's face, like, a friend. You know, I don't think she'd had a friend in Storybrooke. She was the mayor, and she controlled everybody, but
yes.
But not a friend.
It's true. And there seems to be some genuine chemistry between the two, because they share something. Catherine tells Regina about how difficult it is to live with David, because he doesn't recognize her. And he says, I lost him once, and now I have him back, but I still don't have him back. And you don't know how that feels. And then Regina answers, well, actually, I do, because I lost someone too. And so I was...
This all, to me, goes back to the, you know, is what's between her and Snow White? Is it a love issue? Is it a mm-hmm. family issue? And is she referring to her father? Because that was the only person
that's
we ever saw in the fairy tale world that she cared about, was her father.
And that's
and she
what,
lost
yeah,
him.
That's what I thought.
Him. But or is there more backstory, which you got to believe there is.
Oh, there certainly is.
You know,
is.
That we're going to now get into for her.
But if this line has a deeper meaning, you know, I lost him once, now I have him back, but I still don't have him back. Could that, you know, that would fit, I think, the situation with Henry, her father, who she killed, and now she has Henry back, but it's a different Henry, it's a young Henry, and he's not really hers, because it's, you know, she doesn't own him, even though she wants to, because it's not really her child. So, or
although she did say the love she lost is not, she can't bring him back. There's mm-hmm. no bringing him back.
Yeah,
right. So that's what I was thinking. Her father,
but Henry could be kind of the replacement for her father, but it's not truly the same. So that might be that ambiguity in that relationship. That she, of course, Henry is now family, but. Can't really take the place of the father that she killed.
Lisa had a theory in, I believe, episode 3 about Snow Falls, about the relationship between Regina and Snow White, or excuse me, Snow White and the Evil Queen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's spot on right in there, because the Evil Queen is always, almost always cast as a stepmother. But there's just a lot of little hints, I think, that Lisa's picked up on that imply that they're related, or they have some close familial relationship that's been broken apart.
Like who? A relationship between who?
Snow White and the Evil Queen.
Oh,
that maybe
okay.
They were sisters or stepsisters or, you know,
half.
To me, almost something to do. She said he today. I mean, in the episode last night or last
yeah.
Sunday. But I always wondered if it maybe had something to do more with their mother, or that... you know,
uh-huh.
that we don't know about, or Snow White took away the love of the mother, maybe, you know, something like that to me. I just, you know, things are always, I don't say worse, but, you know, more volatile when they're family related.
Yes.
And for that yes. kind of hate and animosity between the two, Shelley, did you laugh?
Yeah.
Tell us about it as sisters.
No, but if she drove a wedge between the, let's say she's the evil stepmother, if she drove a wedge, Snow, maybe the husband loved Snow more or took Snow's side on something, that would drive a huge wedge. I'm reminded again of that Cinderella movie Ever After with Drew Barrymore in mm-hmm. the beginning, and the stepmother never really loved what do they call her in that movie? But she didn't love her, the mm-hmm. Drew Barrymore character, because she had the love of the father more than the father loved his second wife.
So could it be that that Regina, or the evil queen, is actually the older sister of Snow White? Would that make sense?
I think so.
Older half-sister or even
or half-sister, yeah, something in that
definitely
situation.
A familial relationship.
Well, Regina seems to be a bit too young to be Snow White's mother, although, well...
Stepmother.
I'm still thinking on the stepmother angle, actually, just because if, you know, right along with, you know, if Snow White always had the love of the father that the queen could never get, and then at that one point when
you're right.
Snow White and Prince Charming got married, the prince said to the queen, "You're not the queen anymore." If those two had gotten married, then James would have been the king, and so on and so forth. So she would no longer be the queen.
Hmm. Yes.
I'm just kind of winging that based on how the royal stuff usually works.
Yeah. So Snow White would take the place of the evil queen in terms of power.
Right. So if she, you know, so if Snow White married before the queen ever did, then they would.
That's interesting.
That's my guess.
Mm-hmm. That could be a good explanation of the rivalry and why Snow White is such a threat to Regina, to the evil queen. Let's see. There are some more details, of course, in the beginning of the story. Again, Mary is trying to put up a bird's house in the tree when David arrives, and he helps her put that in the tree. And that's the constant reference to the bluebirds that we see both in the fairy tale world, but also in the storybook world. And that refers clearly to the way that Snow White was visualized in the Disney version of Snow White, where she was constantly playing around with these little bluebirds and using them as messengers. So I thought it was an interesting continuation of that reference. Mm-hmm. Interesting conversation between the two, where David is like, "Well, don't you feel it? Don't you feel the connection that we have? Isn't this mutual? Don't tell me this is one-sided." And then Mary Blanchard's very honest response, you know, "You're married, so it should be one-sided."
I think she said there should be no-sided.
Oh, I thought
that's right.
Okay.
She said it should be no-sided.
But
yeah, I love the constant morality theme that
leads,
especially this show. You heard it over and over,
yes.
where Emma said, "If it doesn't feel right, usually isn't right." And,
yes.
I love the way that they keep going back to that. You know, that there's that nagging feeling. You know, it's right. This is right. And this episode had it all over the place.
And there's this constant tension between what you might feel for someone, and then what is the right thing to do. And it's also one of the main questions that Rumpelstiltskin asks Prince Charming. He says, "Well, you know, because he feels coerced into accepting this new role as the, you know, taking over the job of his brother." He says, "I don't have a choice, do I?" And then Rumpelstiltskin says, "Yes, you have a choice. Everyone has a choice. You just have to make the right one." And I think that is the main theme, again, and I've noticed this in previous episodes, that Rumpelstiltskin always seems to hit the nail on the head when it comes to what is the main message of the episode. And in this case, it seems to be, you know, you might feel one way, but you have to make a choice, not always just based on your feelings.
Choices was the main, that was the very first thing I wrote down on my notepad when I was watching it again. Choices. Everything is a choice. We didn't really do a recap, so I hate kind of going all over the place, but
oh,
I'm
no going to
jump right in here.
Go ahead. Our listeners have seen the episode.
The parents chose to give up one of their twin sons. That's a choice. Shepherd, he wants to choose love. David says he didn't choose Catherine. David tells Mary Margaret, I choose you.
Yeah.
Mary Margaret struggles. She has to choose the right path. And then, if you want me to go all the way to the end of the show, David does make a choice.
Yes.
And nobody's happy with the choice. Again, though, I feel like he didn't feel like he had a choice. It was the right thing to do.
Exactly. It's a tragic choice with consequences for both of them. But it's based on what he knows and what he thinks the situation is. But again, these are fake memories. I think he makes the right choice based on what he knows.
You could almost say it was a Greek tragedy.
In a way, yes. It's kind of this...
Not everybody didn't die at the end.
And everyone knows that the two should belong together. And it's the embodiment of the tragedy of Storybrooke. It has no happy endings. And so in this case, we're all rooting for this love to happen. But this is not a fairy tale. And so, you know, there is no happy ending to this love. At least not now.
Sorry. Not only was there not a fairy tale, but did you notice how much of the Greek was brought in? Again, with the Iliad. King Midas. King Midas is a character in the Iliad. And then goes back to last episode, the dog's name was Ajax.
Mm-hmm.
And the chimera. He said, take the dragon's head and go put it with the chimera and some other thing I didn't recognize. But the chimera is a creature from the Iliad. And so we've brought in this other element. So this other kingdom seems to be the Greek stories.
Yes.
The Greek mythology.
Very interesting.
Hans Christian Andersen, Disney. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fairy tale. I apologize if you can hear my baby in the background.
No, it's no problem. There's a little bit of background noise, but it's no problem.
I think that I read an article that said that all cultures, you know, they were going to translate fairy tales very loosely, so that all cultures, what they considered their fairy tales, were fair game for the show. And so, I mean, I don't know. In a way, can you argue that Greek mythology or, you know, this could be considered a fairy tale type of thing that they want to include?
Well, and in a way, if we can continue to see this connection between ABC's Once Upon a Time and Disney, let's not forget that Disney also based an animated movie on Hercules. So there might be links there too to that story. But for our listeners that might not be completely up to date with this whole, you know, Greek mythology, Shelley, could you give us a brief introduction to the character of Midas and
King Midas? I can't really do the whole Iliad thing. It's been way too long.
Of course.
But King Midas, you know, the story, he wanted treasures, and he made a deal with one of the Greek gods. I think it was Dionysus.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember.
Dionysus.
Thank you, David. So he made a deal with Dionysus, and anything he touched turned to gold, and he was thrilled, and he was happy, and everything was wonderful, except he touched an apple, and it would turn to gold, and he couldn't eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And he touched wine or drink, and he couldn't drink it. And then his daughter ran to him, and she hugged him, and she turned to gold. So here's his daughter, Abigail, and all I could think of was, she's not golden. How did that happen? In some of the stories, he goes back to Dionysus and makes another deal, and the girl is turned back to human. So did he make a deal with Rumpelstiltskin?
I think that's
Abigail, and she's very cold,
obvious,
talking to her father.
Yes.
And yet he says something to the effect of, "There's nothing I treasure more."
Yes. Well, here's a detail that you might have missed, because this, of course, is very good material for a future episode where we see the backstory of King Midas making a deal with Rumpelstiltskin. And let's not forget, this is about gold, and Rumpelstiltskin is all about gold. So very obvious that there's going to be a future episode about this and what happened. But in a throwaway line at the very beginning when the brute seems to be killed by Prince James. We now know that that was the real Prince James. The king approaches, King Midas, and one of his aides takes off the glove, the metal glove that is protecting his hand, and it's glowing. And well, that's when we discover that he has literally the Midas touch, and whatever he touches will turn into gold. And he touches this sword. But when the knight is taking off the glove, Midas says, "Be careful! Remember what happened to Frederick." And I immediately wrote that down. I was like, "Oh, there has been an accident with this. He probably touched, I think, one of his sons, and you know that is why he hasn't got a son himself who can slay the dragon, and that is why he needs the other kingdom to provide their son to do it." And so, and that could also explain why Abigail is so cold and distant and tells her father, "Well, you probably know what's right," because she probably witnessed this whole deal with Rumpelstiltskin and the consequences of that. And so and that's why Midas probably has a different relationship to his daughter, because now she's the only thing that he has, so she is definitely the biggest treasure in his life. But she, of course, has seen how he probably turned his own son into gold. That's kind of my wacky theory of the week.
I don't think it's that wacky, because this is a girl who grew up around a dad who can give her all the money in the world, but he has to always physically keep his distance. So,
ooh, that's a good theory there, David.
Yeah.
That physical love that a father holding or hugging or touching a child in a loving way.
Gold.
Oh, wow.
Replace that love.
With riches.
Good stuff. Yes, indeed. That's a very symbolic thing as well. There's nothing really that can replace true love. Even if you had all the gold in the world, it would still not be enough.
And maybe that's why she is the way she is.
Interesting. Now, the let's see, when the body of Prince James is brought into the castle, we see it's a really nice camera angle from the ceiling. It shows us how the body is carried in, and we see a very quick overview of the circular table, the round table in the castle, and I think we've seen the same table in the pilot episode, but it was I wonder if it was in a different castle or with a different king. I was a bit confused. I was like, I've seen this table.
No, it was when Charming had all the people there, and they were trying to discuss what they were going to do about this curse that was coming.
Oh,
and Jiminy Cricket is on that table, and I remember thinking, oh, it's the round table, King Arthur.
Yes, so that's probably
the father's name,
the same
is
castle.
Not King Arthur.
No.
The father's name is not said until the end of the episode, and it's King George.
Okay.
That's when I went, oh, St. George and the Dragon.
That makes sense, yes. So the, obviously the circular table is a reference to the famous round table, and I counted it I freeze-framed it. There are 12 sections in this table, and every section has a different animal painted on it. So I saw a lion, an eagle, a horse, a goat, a fish, and some other symbols that I couldn't really figure out. Well, you could say the zodiac, but I don't think those were zodiac animals. I had to do some research on Wikipedia about the whole where does this round table come from, and it originally appears in a tale written by a certain Wace, and he wrote Roman the Brute. Now we know that the giant that attacked Prince James is called a brute, right? By Midas and by several others. So this tale from 1155 is a Norman language adaptation of another story, an older story. So we don't know exactly how old this whole legend of the Round Table is. But Apparently, according to this tale, King Arthur created the Round Table to prevent quarrels among his barons, none of whom would accept a lower place than the others. And that's why the table is round, so everybody has an equal importance, as it were. Now, originally, in these early stories about the Round Table, there were many more. This was a gigantic table, and there were a lot of knights, I think in some stories, even a couple of hundred or 150 in one story. However, in the later version, around 1190, there is a new version of this story of the Round Table, and it appears in Merlin, the story of Merlin, written by Robert de Boron. And in this version, the wizard Merlin is the one who creates the Round Table, but he does that, and this is medieval story, so it's very Christian culture in which this story is written. Merlin wants this table to imitate the table of the Last Supper, the table of the Holy Grail, which is, of course, the cup of Christ. And so that is why this version of the Round Table has 12 seats, referring, of course, to the 12 apostles. And one of the seats is always empty because it symbolized Judas, who went away to betray Jesus. And so it's very interesting to see that how this ancient tale was kind of Christianized in the version of 1190. And that's what kind of the depiction that we see later on in fairy tales and in the legends about King Arthur. So there's a connection that is made to the story of the Last Supper, and then the whole quest of the Holy Grail, which of course is a very, very important myth in all the medieval stories. But of course, Shelley, I'm sure that you are able to give a much more literary correct tale or account of this whole history. I don't know if
of
we
the
have
round
time.
Table?
Yeah, the Round Table and the whole backstory of that.
Not off the top of my head. I didn't go and look up a lot of that before this episode. I was stuck more on the relationships and the choices that people were making, mm-hmm. and how they were related to each other. So like yeah. with the shepherd, going back again to the shepherd with the widowed mother, on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And we never found out his name, and he's pretty shocked to hear that his dad gave him up.
Yes.
So, and then he's shocked, with the whole Rumpelstiltskin appearing, he chooses to go with him. Mm-hmm. But again, I get the feeling he didn't feel like he had a choice. And then he goes to kill the dragon, and you notice he's asking the guy, he's very hesitant, he's a simple shepherd, and he's like, so did you know my brother well? They're
yeah.
like, yes, it's a... the bravest, most honorable, most loyal man we've ever met. And he's kind of like, oh, okay, so a lot to live up to here. But when he's fighting this dragon, this is not a wimpy little dragon like you see in some of the more popular movies. And I dare say it even puts some of the Harry Potter dragons to shame.
It does,
This dragon breathes fire, and woo, that guy was melted in seconds.
Now, did you notice how he used the same trick that he used in the when he was still in the countryside to get the goat inside the fence?
He didn't see that one coming.
Yeah. And he uses the same trick here with the dragon.
And I like the biblical reference in the beginning to the lost lamb. He had that whole pen full of sheep, and he was getting that one lost lamb.
Of course,
when we see him.
Yes.
So, and here, bringing it back.
Of course, the name David, and it's a very clear reference to the story of King David. So perhaps David, you can refresh our memory and tell us a little bit about it, since it's your name as well.
since I'm the expert,
King David.
It kind of goes along with the biblical story. Just because it's all of a sudden the shepherd is plucked out of nowhere and told that he must fight this giant. And in the Bible, David is supposed to fight this huge Philistine named Goliath, who's taken on dozens of soldiers on his own, and just mm-hmm. wiped them all out. And he, instead of picking up a sword and trying to take him on, he picks up the sling that he uses in his he uses in his work, and just knocks and just uses the sling to knock out the giant.
Yes, indeed.
And although in Once Upon a Time, the prince doesn't have a sling. He doesn't take the dragon head on like everyone else does. He uses his brains, just like the biblical story.
And then
that was cool.
Doesn't David in the original biblical story also cut off the head of the giant?
Very true. He picks up the sword after he's knocked out the giant. He cuts off his head so he can bring it back to King Saul, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's what happens. And so here you've got exactly the same thing happening with the head of the dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And again, yeah, it's true. He also uses his brains to defeat the dragon instead of just brute force. Hey, let's take a short break before we continue our analysis of the episode Shepherd of Once Upon a Time. And we'll be back right after this.
Grass.
Every story needs a memorable detail.
Every story needs a memorable detail, and every podcast needs some memorable details. And one detail that I shouldn't skip is the fact that this episode is brought to you by our sponsors, Bluehost, which is a great company that provides you with unlimited bandwidth and storage space and a .com domain name for a flat fee of $6.95 per month, and really easy to install a blog. I love it. I use it for my personal blog, and it's just a great deal. So go check it out on onceuponatime.sqpn.com if you want to set up your own blog about Once Upon a Time or about anything else. It's it's so cheap that you can just experiment and learn how to do this, and it's really simple. You don't have to be very technical to set up your own website. So that's a great deal, and by clicking on that banner, you will support our podcast. And we're also sponsored by the Amazon store. We're an affiliate. So if you click on the Amazon icon before you go shop at Amazon, that will also help us out financially. And the cool thing is, of course, it's almost Christmas when we're recording this. And so if you go Christmas shopping, and who doesn't, this is a easy and totally free way to support our podcast and help us pay the bandwidth cost and everything. Just make sure that before you go and buy a book or a car or a television at Amazon, just click on that link on the little icon on onceuponatime.sqpn.com. Thanks in advance. And finally, we're in the middle of our giving campaign because SQPN, the platform that produces this show, but also, you know, Secrets of Disney, Secrets of Harry Potter, we've got a lot of podcasts. We're a nonprofit organization, and so we can do this because we're helped by and sponsored by our listeners. So if you want to become a sponsor of this show and some of the other shows that we do, it's very easy to sign up either to be a one-time donor or even to become a friend of SQPN, you know, a monthly donor. That makes it even easier. You don't have to think about it all the time. And you can find all the information on onceuponatime.sqpn.com. Just click on the little, you know, the pig that, you know, the savings pig, or how do you call that?
the piggy bank.
That, there you go. And you can find out how you can support us. So let's get back to Once Upon a Time.
I wish, but nothing changes. I wish I was better at wishing.
I need to make some new jingles with the based on the newer episodes, but we'll have some time because, of course, the series is going on a winter hiatus. The December 11th is the last episode before the new year, and then it's coming back in January. Now, if you're listening to this podcast months after we recorded it, because you're watching this in, I don't know, in Australia or in Europe or anywhere else on the planet, then this doesn't really matter to you. But for us, it's going to be a painful month without new episodes of Once Upon a Time. But I guess we have so much to talk about that we can easily continue our podcast, even though there are no new episodes. So let's go back to
Father.
Yes, go ahead, David.
I have to drop off,
No problem. Go slay some dragons there.
Plan to.
Thank you for coming on the show, David, and talk to you next time.
Bye, David.
Bye.
Bye, David.
So the episode had, of course, many other details. What I really liked was the revelation that the king and the queen were infertile. Of the one kingdom, you know, the king who was dressed in red, and that it was Rumpelstiltskin who gave them their son. And I don't know what you thought, but he mentions, you know, I gave you a son and the price was a pittance. And then he reveals that the queen is now dead. So do you think that that is related? What do you think happened?
You know, that puzzled me this whole episode was, you know, Rumpelstiltskin is all over their choices in this episode and their problems. But I couldn't figure out what the price was for each of these, you know, each of the times he helped them, you know? So maybe that's very well could be with the king. Mine, and maybe I missed it, y'all can help me, but when he came, what did he get in return for helping the king the second time?
Oh, he got the whereabouts of the fairy godmother.
Yes.
The one that he poofed for Cinderella and picked up the wand.
Okay, so he hasn't already poofed her yet.
I think this is, now we know how he found the location of the fairy godmother.
Okay.
And so the king is betraying, actually, the protection of this fairy godmother, which I think is kind of a mortal sin in the fairy tale world. It's very harsh. And he
gave her up. He traded the life for a life.
Yeah, but it's terrible. And then he also, later on, tells his stepson, actually, you know, you're just going to marry that girl or I will destroy your mother's farm and your mother. You know, he's extremely ruthless.
Didn't he say, I will kill you?
I'll kill you, I'll kill your mother, and I will turn that farm of yours to ash.
Horrible. That's pretty harsh.
And we learned one important thing in this episode about magic in the fairy tale world.
Yes.
Rumpelstiltskin told him magic cannot bring back a life.
Indeed.
We did learn that there's a line, and we just found it.
Very interesting, by the way, and if I can do a short reference to Harry Potter and the Harry Potter stories, magic there is very similar in that it seems to be this incredibly powerful force, but if you know Harry Potter and the story and how it evolves and how it ends, we discover that magic is very limited, actually, in what it can do. It can only manipulate what is already there, what is already existing, but it cannot really resurrect anyone. It's inferior to a much deeper magic, what they call the old magic, and that is actually a metaphor of love. And it's love that is the true magic of the Harry Potter world. And I think in this story, in Once Upon a Time, it's very much the same kind of relationship between magic and love. Magic cannot bring someone back from the dead, but remember, love can. A kiss in the fairy tale world can resurrect someone. It can bring Snow White back to life.
And magic can't create true love.
That is true.
We've learned that.
Yes.
They can put people together, but you can't. You know, we saw that with James's face with Abigail. And then at the end, they can force them together, but it can't diminish his love for Snow White or Mary Margaret or make him love Catherine, which, again, shows you the limits of what all of this grand magic can do.
Yeah, and I think the mother understood that. When he goes back to the farm and he's saying goodbye to her, and she's willing to give it all up. She's willing to die. She's willing to give up the farm. She says, your freedom to choose is more important than anything. But she gives him that ring. And she doesn't say, give this ring to your bride or give this ring to, you know, the princess. Mm-hmm. She says, true love follows this ring wherever it goes. You'll find love, you'll be happy. At least I know. I'll never see you again, but at least I know you'll find love, you'll be happy, as long as you have this ring. And of course, this is the very end here. It segues into he's got the ring, he goes back, it's in the pouch, and they're going to take the scenic route. And we all know who's waiting up in the tree to pounce. That mischievous little smile. The ring brought him true love. And I think even the King George said, when he sends them off, farewell, you're on the path to true love. But then they go back to the real world and Mary Margaret still has that ring. She's crying over that ring, with that ring in her hand. So the ring's definitely going to bring them back together somehow, that the true love, even the mother's blessing on that ring.
If that ring is still active, if the curse hasn't somehow, you know, blocked the power of that ring, or the, I don't know, well, time will tell. But yes,
but how does Mary Margaret have the ring?
Well, if, there, yes. Know, well, there's some.
What else came through?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of things, actually. We see the.
We saw the mobile, the unicorn
exactly.
mobile.
We see the inside of the pawn shop, and we see lots of magical
okay,
objects.
How many times did you pause it and rewind just to look at the inside of the pawn shop? Because
yes.
I know I was freeze framing everything, trying to, you know, because you know they put a ton of stuff in there to kind of help you figure out what's coming next. And so
yes. Absolutely, and stuff from the previous episodes as well.
So was the tea set? Was the tea set Alice in Wonderland? Is that the Mad Hatter's tea set?
Could be, but it could. I think it's more a reference to something that we've. And this is a slight spoiler, so please close your ears for 5 seconds if you don't want to hear this. But we already know that Belle and the Beast is going to be a part of the series, and so this could be very well the magic. You know, the teacups that are singing and dancing around.
Oh, yes. That's true.
So I think it's setting that up.
We saw Aladdin's lamp again.
Absolutely.
And the mobile, the baby, Snow White and Prince Charming's babies are Emma's mobile.
And I love that. I love that joke where you know he's touching the mobile and then you hear Mr. Gold's voice like, "Charming, isn't it?" I thought it was brilliant.
He just says "Charming."
Yes.
And he looks up and you think,
yes.
"Oh, he remembers."
He remembers his name.
Oh.
Yes.
But that was a real pivotal scene there in the. In the Mr. Gold's pawn shop, because you know Regina had told Mary Margaret earlier, give him the, what was it? She said, give him the space to choose. Let him remember who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's in the pawn shop, and Regina has given him misdirections on purpose. So
yes.
She knew he'd end up in that pawn shop, and he sees the mobile, and you think, oh, any little thing can trigger it. But then he turns around, and as he's walking out, he's made his choice. He's going to Mary Margaret. He's left Catherine. He's walking out, he sees the windmill. And for whatever reason, the windmill is the magic that Regina had placed there for him to run into. And boom, it's like all of a sudden he remembers Catherine.
You think the windmill was a setup by Regina?
Yes.
That's an interesting theory.
Because
I was wondering about
it. He turns and he sees
it. Yes.
And Mr. Gold is very quiet. He's very still. And he says, are you sure?
Oh, wow.
And then when he goes back to Mary Margaret, she says, and you love her? He says, well, I don't know, but I know I did. And I have to honor that. I have feelings for you, but going back to her, it's the right thing to do. So all again, we keep coming back to making that choice and
yes.
feeling like you're trapped in a place, but you've got to do the right thing.
Well, and it's kind of the princely thing to do. It's exactly what he does when he accepts the role of Dragon Slayer. He knows that he doesn't want that, but he and when he accepts to marry Abigail, he does it for the kingdom, not for his own good, but for the good of everyone. And so there's this very noble, virtuous attitude of the common good is more important than my personal well-being or my own feelings. And that's you can't get any more noble than that. It's sacrificing your own interests for the good of everyone. So it's a truly, I think, a royal gesture.
Now, I wondered if the windmill had some sort of symbolism. The first time I saw it, I thought, of course, of Don Quixote, where he's going after, you know, something that isn't there. It's an illusion. It's all in his imagination. The windmill representing, of course, giants.
Could be. Yeah.
Him going after it. But then I Googled it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not know this, but Hans Christian Andersen actually wrote a short story called The Windmill.
Yes, I remember that, actually.
Oh, you're familiar with that one.
I don't remember exactly the story, but I know that it was in my children's fairy tale book.
It's very, very short. And what I took from it that I really remembered was the windmill is personified, and he has all these thoughts. And the thoughts are the people that live inside the windmill. And it's a miller and his family. And then I'm sitting here thinking of this, and Mr. Gold says something. It reminded me that Regina's last name on the show is Mills, the mayor. Mayor Mills.
Oh, yes.
And then earlier in the episode, I remembered the mother had said she was going to set him up with the grain merchant's daughter.
Yes,
I thought, oh, that could be Snow, or oh, that could be Regina. But that was before I knew where in the timeline this episode fit, so to speak. So
but there are definitely
it could be a red herring.
Well, but there are definitely a lot of. It's a little bit too much of a coincidence to have Regina Mills, to have this mill, and Regina might have something to do with that. It was something that Prince Charming hated. He says it. I hated that mill. Or at least that's what Catherine reminds him of. You hated that mill. And then, yes, indeed, the grain merchant. Well, is there a connection there? I don't know. But it's. I was like, there has to be a backstory to this. But it's kind of frustrating because we don't have all the facts. I don't have enough to speculate with. But perhaps our listeners are smarter than I am. I'm pretty sure that they are. So you can always go to the blog at onceuponatime.sqpn.com and let us know what your theory is about this whole, you know, windmill, grain, Regina Mills, what the connection could be.
Well, something else to pose to the listeners might be the meaning behind that shield. The heraldry symbols on the shield.
I was thinking of that. You see, seven flowers and a lion on it.
Mm-hmm. There's the blue lion, and he's facing to the left.
Yes.
And there's a red chevron, and then there are seven, and I couldn't tell if they were blue roses with points or if they were stars. And I did try and pause that one a couple of times to make sure, because seven is going to be an important number. We know from Lost and from this episode already, they like numbers.
Well, it's a biblical number, and it's the heraldry of the kingdom of Midas, right? Because he's
no, that was the heraldry of King George.
Are you sure?
Midas's were red and another color. I can't remember.
Oh,
and they had,
yes, you're right.
They
of
had
course,
three
yes.
of some kind of an animal on one side.
No, you're right. You're right. It's George because he. It's kind of a courtesy of the kingdom of King George to the kingdom of Midas. I was like, okay, he's now working for Midas, but that's not the case. So do you have any theories about that? Or is it just like, something else that we probably will discover later on?
I don't know, but I knew not to take anything at just face value. So as soon as I saw the shield, I know there's a lot of meaning behind each and every placement.
Yes.
Of something on there. It usually is a family crest or a family coat of arms, but I didn't have time this morning to go and look up what roses or stars meant or a red. The color means something. The placement on the shield means something. So hopefully our listeners will hear it and know more about heraldry symbols and be able to send us feedback on that.
That'd be great. Now, something much more obvious in terms of what it means and why it's in the scene is the bottle of whiskey. Did you notice that? McCutcheon whiskey. And this is an inside joke for those of you that have watched Lost. It is the fictional brand of whiskey that you see all the time in Lost. And especially when the big bad guy, Charles Widmore, is in a scene. He seems to love this brand of whiskey. Now, King George is actually played by the same actor who played Charles Widmore in Lost. And so that was a very funny joke for the Lost aficionados there. And of course,
I didn't see that. Lisa, I think, dropped off the call by accident.
Oh, okay. I might be able to bring her back.
But I didn't watch Lost. Lisa watched Lost. That's what made me realize she was gone.
Oh, okay, yes.
But I did see on Twitter where everybody was yelling, Widmore, and I'm like, who is Widmore? But thank you for telling me it was King George was the actor.
We have actually listeners both that have watched Lost multiple times and are super excited about every little reference. And then we also got some feedback from people like, oh, please, I've never watched Lost. I don't understand these references. Can you talk about something else?
Well, they do like to throw in a lot of Lost in the dialogue, I've noticed. Like, are you lost?
Or yes.
Have you lost your way?
I mean, these are the writers of Lost.
Yeah, Regina said it to him, are you lost?
Mm-hmm.
He's like, well, I was looking for the path to the toll bridge.
Yes. Some other minor details here and inside jokes. Just before they are about to attack the dragon, one of the knights is talking literally about the dragon's lair. And this was a very well-known Laserdisc video game when I was a kid.
from 1983. It's called Dragon's Lair. You can still actually buy it now for mobile devices. You can play it on your iPhone or iPad. It's a lot
of
fun.
My husband has it on the iPad.
I love that game. It's kind of an interactive animated movie. It was created by ex-Disney animator Don Bluth. And at the time, it was revolutionary technology. Nowadays, it's kind of like, oh, it's just an animated movie, and you have to press buttons to trigger yet another movie. So it's very primitive in terms of gameplay. But that was at the time that, you know, most video games, it's just a bunch of colored pixels on the screen. And this was like actually being able to play a character in a Disney movie. That's how it looked. So yeah. I thought it was a nice reference again to that classic
game. I wondered if
game.
They were making a reference. I did not know that Dragon's Lair, the video game, was done by an ex-Disney engineer, but you and I are about the same age. I remember when it came out. It was a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
And once he said it, Dragon's Lair, I went, oh, and the knights were dressed exactly like the Dragon's Lair knight in the video game.
Oh, I didn't notice that. That is too funny.
The chainmail and the way the helmets
fit. Oh, gosh. Yeah, some people thought that there were also references to the Monty Python movie about the grill. But I've seen that movie. It's a classic one, but not recently, so I couldn't really recognize it. I didn't see any, you know, like direct references. But it wouldn't surprise me.
It wouldn't surprise me, but I think it'd be more in the dialogue or a look that they'd give each other.
Could be. And then there's the nice switch from the golden sword to the golden letter opener in the classroom. I thought that was funny. And then there's this joke. I guess it's a kind of an inside joke, or it might have a meaning when it comes to the identity of Graham, our favorite Storybrooke sheriff, when he presents Emma with a donut box and she chooses the bear claw.
Yeah.
Now, this is the first time in my life that I heard about a pastry being called a bear claw.
Oh no, that's common over here.
Is that common? Oh wow,
mm-hmm.
It looked like one of those 1,000 calories a piece.
Maybe 2,000 calories.
Oh my goodness. But I mean, it kind of fits Graham. If he is indeed the huntsman, then that makes sense that he is. Well, he's bringing in a bear claw.
Can we talk about the preview for the next episode yet?
Well, let's do that. I've got a few more things here. Okay. And then, yes, we definitely have to talk about that. I haven't seen it yet, though. So there is one question that I had about this whole, you know, you've got two kingdoms. You've got King Midas' kingdom, and he can turn everything into gold, but yet he has no son to slay the dragon. So there's something broken in that kingdom. And then you've got the kingdom of King George, where they have no money, no riches, but they do have heroes. And the reason, of course, that King George wants to deal with King, or wants to help out King Midas, is that he needs gold, he needs money. And there are constant references to the fact that King George's kingdom is very poor. Prince Charming's mother is poor, that farm is poor. And that reminded me of the conversation between Cinderella when she's trying to renegotiate her deal with Rumpelstiltskin. And she tells Rumpelstiltskin, you know, our kingdom is extremely poor, you know, but the crops aren't growing. If I give you my second child, or, you know, my child, then or the other twin, then, you know, please help us in that situation. But then I was getting very confused, because her kingdom, her father, was yet another king, wasn't he?
It was Prince Thomas's.
Yes, but
Cinderella.
Prince Thomas's father is not King George, and it's not King Midas.
That's true. That would be three kingdoms now that we've seen.
So there is a third kingdom. And so I somehow keep thinking that Prince Charming is the one who was supposed to bring these three kingdoms together and perhaps seal it through by a marriage or by a wedding or something like that.
By a ring?
Yeah, or...
I'm sorry, I couldn't help throw that in there. A ring. You know, Lord of the Rings.
Oh, gosh, yes. The one
Precious.
Ring that unites them all. But what if Snow White is from the third kingdom?
I don't know. I keep thinking that there has to be something about that marriage, why it's so important, and why the evil queen, the evil queen was so, you know, stubborn to break up that wedding and not let that happen, as if literally the entire fairy tale world depended on it, or the future of the fairy tale world.
I think you're onto something.
She divides. She's the clear, you know, the bad guy, you know, Satan divides, and the shepherd unites. The shepherd brings the flock together, and the evil queen and Rumpelstiltskin, those are, you know, evil always separates people and create, you know, introduces wedges in relationships.
Well, by that theory, Snow White's kingdom would have to be more powerful than Midas's, or bring something better to the table, because what they haven't showed us is how he's able to get out of the deal with Midas and Abigail and marry instead Snow White. It didn't sound like King George was just going to let him out of that deal with Abigail.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, he just does it. So
Oh, nothing just happens. Well, there's going to be a story, of course, that's going to come into play.
Well, Rumpelstiltskin actually gets his revenge, or gets his prize, by, of course, aiming for the daughter of Snow White, which is Emma. So there might be, you know, that might be his way to actually get what he wanted.
Did I tell you my theory last week about why Rumpelstiltskin wanted to know Emma's name?
I don't remember.
Well, my theory was that Rumpelstiltskin knew that the Evil Queen was going to release this curse, and he's the one who created the curse. And I think when he told them that Emma would be the savior, the baby would be the savior, and the way to break the curse, I think that by getting her name, by having the name, gave him the power to retain his memory when the curse was enacted, like a backdoor, like programmers build in a backdoor to their computer program.
That is interesting.
That's how he's able to come forward, and he knows what's going on. He's just watching it all kind of unfold, and he's got his finger on the pulse of everything.
Yeah, yeah. Which brings me to this, it's another detail, and I can't believe I only saw that now, but remember, every episode has this intro text when we see, you know, we get a little bit of a rundown of what happened before, and then that whole introduction ends with the phrase, "Only one knows the truth, only one can break her spell," referring to the evil curse, and they show Emma, and you think it's about her, but I'm starting to die. Actually, I don't think it's about Emma. Only one knows the truth. Is this Henry? Well, he doesn't know everything either. I think this text refers to Rumpelstiltskin indeed. He is the only one who knows the truth. He's the only one who can truly break the spell. Why does he need that wand? Still haven't got an answer to that either. But
he wanted the wand in the fairy tale. And if they're referring to breaking the spell, that would be in the real world.
Yeah. Or does he need Emma to break the spell and get back? I mean, I can imagine that even Rumpelstiltskin wants to go back to the former situation, right?
Well, one would think.
So is he going to... I don't... Who is going to be the one that breaks the spell? Emma doesn't know the truth.
Well, the thing that drives me crazy about shows like this is I don't know when or how they're going to end it. And so you've got this great story, and it's just going to twist and turn and build one layer on top of another. And then it'll be so convoluted by the end of the run, by the end of the season. I'm sorry, not season, the series.
Mm-hmm.
And if so, when they get to the end of that, will we even remember?
Yeah.
what we cared about in the beginning.
That was one of the
shows like this have a tendency to run and run and run.
Yes.
And by the time they end, you're not invested in it anymore. You don't have the emotional attachment to it.
That is the big danger for shows like this. On the other hand, they will probably give us enough to keep hooked. You know, they answer questions every episode. Even this episode showed us more backstory, and so we're like, aha. But then it also opens up new questions. That's part of the storytelling technique. We've seen Lost, we've seen Battlestar Galactica and series, long-lasting series like that. And even Lost didn't really wrap up everything and didn't answer everything. And And yet, I thought it was okay. They answered enough. And some series really jumped a shark, like, Twin Peaks and The X-Files. They really didn't know how to end the show because they didn't have this overall plan. I think that with the success of series like Lost and these same writers being involved, you can pretty much be certain that they know how to wrap up the series. Even if the show gets canceled at one point, they'll probably have negotiated a deal where they can wrap it up, you know, either very quickly or over this time span of several seasons. I hope for the latter, of course. Now, there's one last thing that we need to do before we can look forward and look ahead to the final episode of Once Upon a Time before the winter break, and that is, of course, our segment about the meaning of names.
Do you think we need code names?
Is this Cobra our code name?
That's the mission. I mean, us. I need something to call you.
Oh. You can just call me Emma for now.
Okay, well then, I'll see you later, Emma.
So every episode introduces new characters and new names, and so far we've seen almost always seen that these names carry a meaning that is important to the story. Abigail, who's introduced here, is it's probably part of the same mythology as Midas, but it's not. I didn't find any Abigail in the story of Midas, of King Midas, but instead it is a Hebrew name, and the meaning originally was father of exaltation, which didn't really give me a clue as to why she's called Abigail. It's an American name that you hear in the United States, but they could have called her anything. However, and then I did a little bit more digging, and then I was like, oh, now I understand. Abigail is actually the name of King David's third wife, and she was described as being good in discretion and beautiful in form. That explains it.
And the name I had for Abigail was Father Rejoicing, or Rejoice for the Father. And so I wondered if that wasn't also a nod to the Midas had turned his daughter into gold, or that he loved his daughter and made the deal with Rumpelstiltskin to maybe bring her back to life. She wasn't dead. She was simply frozen in gold.
Gosh, that's an interesting one as well. That somehow there's another deal going, and that's why he's so fond of her. But then, of course, we've got this name, Frederick, popping up in the beginning of the episode. Could that have been Midas' son? The name of Frederick is from Old German, and it means peaceful ruler. So it could be a fitting name for a prince, of course, but it could also mean that there is yet another king that somehow got turned into gold, or perhaps his father? I don't know.
Or even his champion.
Oh, who knows? Yes. So
there were two other names that were introduced, but I didn't look them up.
Yes.
When they were at the party.
Yes.
You have to figure that this means something. Mm-hmm. But they were introduced to Jean and his wife, Ellen.
Oh, I thought it was Jim?
I thought it was Jean.
Oh, Jean like in, how would you spell that?
G-E-N-E. The man's name, Jean.
Okay.
If Lisa had been back, she might have had something on that. But
did she drop off the call again?
To the call.
No, I think she should be there. Let me see. Okay, I'm bringing her back. Yeah, she dropped off. There must be a bit of a problem with the internet connection. In the meantime, I'm looking up the meaning of Jean here. It's from a Greek origin. It means well-born and noble. I didn't recognize the guy, actually, but... or was he... No, he wasn't. Was he the father of Thomas?
They didn't say.
No, I don't remember. His wife was Ellen. So it's a short form of Eugene. Well-born noble seems to... I mean, I was like, yeah, this could be a character that we'll see in one of the future episodes. And then let me look up Ellen meaning and see what Google will tell us there. Ellen is also a Greek name. How interesting. It means sunray, shining light. It's a variant of Helen. So, interesting. A ray of sunshine. And then you also briefly hear the name Frank. And then we also, at the party, we see Dr. Will. And I still cannot figure out who he is.
Oh, no. He's the big bad wolf.
You think so?
He's got to be. Somebody on Twitter or one of our feedback, I think, had mentioned it briefly. But I just... Whale and wolf. And this is going to sound crazy, but if you Google whale and wolf, you get these stories that they think the evolution of the whale, because the whale is a mammal in water, actually came from a wolf.
Really?
I don't know if this is real or if this
that
is like some
fishy to me.
fake thing that they put.
Are,
hey,
are you back again? Welcome back. Sorry, the connection dropped.
I don't know what happened. Everything just kind of froze up.
Yeah, there must be either something in the computer or our internet connection might be a bit wanky. But anyway,
I was just telling Father, I think that Dr. Whale is really the big bad wolf.
Oh, I have read some stuff online about him. Okay, but who's going to die this week?
Okay.
Oh, we haven't gone there yet.
We need to go there now.
Oh, are y'all still recording? I thought y'all were done.
No. We're still live.
I'm sorry.
No problem. So is there, I assume there's a trailer for next week. What's the title of the episode?
Did they have a title?
I haven't looked
up the title.
Yes, there must be. Actually, on IMDb, you can see even the cast for many future episodes. So after the shepherd comes the heart. The heart is a lonely hunter. That's episode 7.
This is the huntsman.
Yes. This is going to be very spoiler-filled. Let me mention the other names. So if you don't like spoilers, stop listening now because, we're going to be... there might be future spoilers. I don't know. I have not seen anything, not read anything. Episode 8 is called Desperate Souls. Episode 9 is called True North. Episode 10 is called 7:15 a.m. Episode 11, The Fruit of the Poisonous Type. That's an interesting one. And then episode 12, Skin Deep. And then 14, 15, there are no longer titles there, but some very intriguing titles. And The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. I'm trying to find the trailer.
On the internet, they do give you who Sheriff Graham is if you go to that episode.
Well, hold on. I found the trailer. Yes, I found the trailer. Let's play that one first, and then we can talk about that very briefly.
Other lives.
Only next Sunday, a vengeful curse trapped them in our world.
They don't remember who they are.
For the first time, one of them will try to break it.
I think we know each other. Not from Storybook.
From where then?
But exposing the truth will cost one of them their life.
Your revenge is almost complete.
The number one new drama of the season, ABC's Once Upon a Time. All new next Sunday at 8, 7 Central.
Wow, that sounds like a pretty good cliffhanger episode.
Mm-hmm. That had me jumping out of my seat more than this episode did.
Spoiler zone. Tell us your theories. And what did you see and what did you read?
Well, what I've heard is someone does die, but I don't know who. But we are led to believe this episode is all about Snow White and the Huntsman and the Evil Queen and that backstory. And in fact, Internet Movie Database lists Sheriff Graham as the Huntsman.
Okay.
Well, he has to be. In this episode, he said he works at an animal shelter.
Yes.
As if to atone for his otherworld crimes of killing animals.
And he had to feed the hounds or the dogs.
Yeah.
But even more important, and this is almost an aside thrown in there, and I have to believe this is setting us up for the next episode. Emma sees him climbing out of Regina's window.
Yes.
She is disgusted. I mean, that's the only word, that she was just aghast that this was happening and happening with Henry in the house. And he looked ashamed and embarrassed. Like, this is not the right choice. This is not the right thing. But then when I saw the preview, I was like screaming at the TV, Lisa was right. Everybody was right. He's the huntsman.
Well, I'm glad that they don't make us wait until the end of the season to discover who he is.
But why is he kissing Emma? He kisses her and his eyes go open like he knows. he knows who he is, and he knows. And then when he goes to Mary Margaret and says, "Do we know each other?" I think we know each other.
Oh, so he might. He starts to wake up.
Mm-hmm. That's how they're billing it. Is that he starts remembering that again? Emma's changing things. And I don't know if they're going to use Emma kissing him. You know, we keep saying how Emma is doing things that changes the curse. And so maybe by kissing her, it wakes something. His memories. Yeah.
Wow.
Like, the prince kissing really Snow White. And the prince kissing Sleeping Beauty. He wakes up. Snow White kissed the
kiss,
prince.
A kiss
David,
always.
Mary Margaret kissed David. He woke up in the toll bridge.
Kiss makes the connection. And it changes things. Oh, wow. Well, that's a lot to look forward to. I can't wait to see this episode. And even better, to talk about it here on The Secrets of Once Upon a Time. I want to give a shout out to our fellow Once Upon a Time podcasters. There are actually a couple of shows now, a couple of podcasts. And, you know, who of us can only do with one podcast about Once Upon a Time? I want to listen to them all. So I want to give a shout out to the Once Upon a Time podcast by Roni Zone. It's an old friend of mine, fellow Star Wars geek as well. And so you can check that one out. AfterBuzz TV Network has a great kind of after show Once Upon a Time, where right after the episode airs, they talk about it. And I saw one more podcast, but I can't find it in the iTunes store yet, but I'll include links to this podcast in our show notes on onceuponatime.sqpn.com. That website is also the place where you can leave your comments. It's also where during the week we post our theories and, you know, anything related to Once Upon a Time. And it's also where you can find all the information about our co-hosts and where you can follow them on the web and where you can find their blogs and podcasts. If you go to sqpn.com, you can also find a list of our other shows that we produce. We've got shows about, gosh, anything we're passionate about, and a lot of shows that talk about movies or, you know, entertainment. I have a weekly show called The Break, which is also kind of a morning show type of format where I talk about a lot of things. So all that can be found at sqpn.com. In the main menu, we have a list of all our shows, but we're also on iTunes. Just type in SQPN in iTunes and that will give you a list of shows. And speaking of iTunes, I would really want to encourage you and invite you, if you have a little bit of time and you love what we do, leave us a review on iTunes. That may seem a bit of effort, but really, 2-3 lines is enough, or give it a rating or both. It helps us so much, and otherwise people will not be able to find this podcast. So I would really be extremely grateful if you could do that and just go to iTunes, type in Once Upon a Time, Secrets of Once Upon a Time, and leave us a short review. It might cost you a few minutes of your time, but it can help the show tremendously. Well, again, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll be back soon with a new episode of Secrets of Once Upon a Time.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.